Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
It's December 21st, 2015, Skype class over Hilo, Hawaii. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 8, Manifestation of Brahma from Garbhodakshay Vishnu, Text 19. Saitamudvikshya tadabjanala Nadibiranta jalam avishvesa Narvagatastat karanala nala Nabing vichinvams tadavindatajaha Saha, he Brahma, itam, in this world, in this way, Udvikshya, contemplating, tat, that, abja, lotus, nala, stem, nadibhi, by the pipe, antajalam, within the water, avishesha, entered into, na, not, arvakgataha, in spite of going inside, tatkaranala, the stem of the lotus, nala, pipe, nabim, of the navel, the chinvan, thinking much of it, tat, that, avindata, understood, aja, the self-born. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Lord Brahma, thus contemplating, entered the water through the channel of the stem of the lotus. But in spite of entering the stem and going nearer to the navel of Vishnu, he could not trace out the root. Purport. By dint of one's personal endeavor, one may go nearer to the Lord. But without the Lord's mercy, one cannot reach the ultimate point. Such understanding of the Lord is possible only by devotional service, as confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita, Bhaktimam Avijananti Yavanyaschasmitatvataha. Saitam udvikshya tad abjanala Nadibir antajalam avivesha Narvagatastat karanala nala Nabim vichinvamstad avimdatajaha. Lord Brahma, thus contemplating, entered the water through the channel of the stem of the lotus. But in spite of entering the stem and going nearer the navel of Vishnu, he could not trace out the root. Ah, the navel of God. So our navels are formed in the womb, of course. We also have a pipe that comes out of our navel and attaches to the mother through the placenta, through which we are nourished. However, the Lord has a stem coming out of his navel. On the top of it is not a placenta. On the top of it is a lotus. And through it, he nourishes. Through his navel and his stem, lotus stem, he nourishes the whole universe, creates the whole universe. He is not nourished by it. He nourishes it. So who could understand this? How is it possible to understand this? Right, the scientists there, trying to find out the origin of the universe. Lord Brahma's Prabhupada said in the previous verse, everyone should ask these questions. What is the origin? How can we find that? How can we understand that the Lord has a navel? Yet he is unborn. And that his navel is nourishing. How do we find out? You know, we make so much effort. Yes, and effort is required. There's no doubt that effort is required. But is effort enough? It's one of our big questions in spiritual life. Is my effort enough? And if my effort isn't enough, why do it at all? What's the relation between effort and mercy? How do I attract mercy by my effort? Not too long ago, I got a wonderful, wonderful letter from a devotee that I know who said that this morning I was dressing the deities, which this devotee does very frequently. And as I was offering my obeisances, I had a vision of Radharani blessing me, but I couldn't figure out what I did. Was it the way I dressed her? Well, I dress Radha and Krishna all the time. Why should I get this momentary vision today? What did I do? You know, can I do it again? And this is the question that Narada Muni asked, right? Narada Muni was, as a little boy, we have some stories of little boys, Narada Muni, Dhruva, Prahlad. As a little boy, Narada Muni was wandering the earth, sat down and meditated, and then he saw the Lord. And he thought, oh, it was what I was doing. And even though the Lord said to him, you won't see me again. But he tried. He tried. Let me do that meditation again. But this time, no, the Lord didn't come. The Lord said, sorry, you're not going to see me again in this life. Of course, Narada continued with meditating, and he continued with serving the Lord. So he continued with some effort, even though the Lord has said, you're not yet perfect, I'm not going to come again. So this happens, I think, to all of us. Maybe we don't get a vision of Radharani blessing us, maybe we do. I know one of my god sisters, I think it was Mahamaya, wrote about how very new in Krishna consciousness when she was dressing the deities, she looked up and saw, I think it was her, looked up and saw the deity of Radharani and didn't look any more like a deity. There was Radharani. And then she thought, oh, I can't get distracted by my vision. I have to dress and get done on time. So we may have had these amazing experiences, whether it's a vision of Krishna, whether it's overwhelming feeling of ecstasy. You know, you eat one gulab jamun and you're transported, or something in a kirtan, something like that. And we think, oh, if I just do that again. You know, materially we have these things called triggers. Just like the hawk finds a mouse under a particular bush, and so it will check that same bush every day for a long time. We have certain foods, certain places, certain activities, which gave us pleasure at one time. And so we keep repeating them, hoping to find that again. And interestingly enough, psychologically, the less reliable our reward is, the more we're likely to repeat the behavior. Now, if we never get a second reward, we'll eventually stop. But such is the psychology, by the way, of gambling. So what person in their right mind would put some small coins into a machine over and over again as a way of making their living? What a boring way to make a living, right? Worse than working in a factory. So why do people do this? Because they never know when the reward's going to come. It's a surprise. Right? If every time you put your coin in the machine, a dollar popped out, you know, you might do it for a day or two, and after that, you would get bored. But because it happens periodically, and it happens without a particular pattern, and that's discernible by us, therefore it's very exciting. So it's something like that, you know, when is Krishna going to appear? When we don't know. We don't know. When is Krishna going to appear? When is he going to show me his mercy? And we try. Let me try the same thing again. Let me go to that festival. I was once talking to a woman newly married who was very angry because her husband said, "Oh, this year we're not going to go to such and such festival." I said, "Why are you so attached to going to that particular festival?" She said, "Well, the first time I went there, I had an amazing spiritual experience. So I have to keep going back to that festival every year." So we can't figure out, you know, what's the relation between effort and mercy? Or maybe there are some things that we do in Krishna consciousness where we never get any reciprocation, you know. There may be some activities we do, maybe our guru has told us to do them, and, you know, we do them and we do them and we do them and there's just nothing. Or it's so rare that we feel we've got worse odds than the guys in the casino, right? And we think, well, I don't know if I should do this anymore. They're not getting some reciprocation from Krishna. So this is our mental quandary of this relationship between effort and mercy. And such a quandary is there, you'll find, in any system of religion. They discuss these things, right? The Sri Vaishnavas split into two groups and they fight about it, as splits within religions tend to do, rather foolishly, we may say. But anyway, they fight about it. And they have the monkey and the kitten group. So if you've been around monkeys, spent any time in Vrindavan or around monkeys, you know that the baby monkey hangs on to the mother. The mother doesn't do anything in particular to hold the monkey. She's jumping around. Years ago, our family ended up raising an orphaned opossum. And similar thing, the mother opossum, who has something like 12 babies at once, as soon as the babies come out of the pouch, they just hang on to her back. And in this case, one of the babies fell off, you know. I guess if you have 12 babies at once and one falls off, and opossums are pretty dull. So the mother didn't notice. And the baby was crying and crying and crying at the temple. And we ended up taking care of it for a while and then releasing it into the wild. So this is the monkey. The monkey is, of course, with monkeys, they're intelligent, not like the opossum, which is very dull. But the intelligent monkeys, if the baby falls off, the mother will go back and find it. So it's the monkey is not completely that it is just simply the effort of the baby monkey. Not entirely. If the monkey loses its grip in some way, the mother will go and rescue it. And then we have the kitten. So the kitten doesn't hold on at all. Right? The kitten doesn't hold on at all. The mother cat picks up the baby kitten by the loose skin on the neck and carries it around. Now, of course, even in that case, the kitten needs to do something. The kitten needs to relax. I mean, the mother cat can carry the kitten around if the kitten's squirming, just like the cat will carry around a rat, and the rat is not cooperating at all, and still the cat is capable of carrying around the rat. Of course, sometimes then the rat gets away, and the cat has to re-catch it. But the kitten is still doing something. The kitten is still aiding by its surrender, aiding by its relaxation, so it doesn't get hurt by the mother cat. But still, we could say that in the case of the monkey, the main responsibility is on the baby, and in the case of the cat, the main responsibility is on the mother. So the Sri Vaishnavas split into two groups, and they fight about this. We're right, you're wrong. You know, all these different groups. And the similar thing happened in Christianity. Right? Because it's very clear in the Bible that one needs to have faith, that if you just believe, Jesus says, if you have faith as small as a mustard seed, you can move mountains. But later on, Paul said, I think it was Paul, he said, faith without works is dead. You have to have both. So the Roman Catholic Church, as it evolved, I don't know if it started this way, but as it evolved, got more and more into the concept of effort, that you have to do something. And they had all kinds of rituals that you had to do. Interestingly enough, Jesus, having appeared within the Jewish tradition, simply followed the Jewish rituals. And later, when Christianity became really a separate religion, they had to invent rituals because the rituals didn't come from any scripture or didn't come from Jesus. So they invented their rituals, and then they said, by these invented rituals, you will be saved. And then starting with Martin Luther, not Martin Luther King Jr., but starting with Martin Luther, he started emphasizing mercy, that it's simply by belief. And we have all these groups of Christians who say, you know, it's just simply if you believe. Simply if you believe, simply if you believe. That's enough. Or one devotee recently sent me a video, I didn't watch the whole thing, of a very popular Christian preacher, someone who fills a stadium with 40 to 50,000 people at a go and has, you know, millions and millions of people tuning into his lectures. And he was making this point. He said, all you have to do is try. He said, God will reward you if you just make the effort. You don't have to succeed. So there's this quandary, this dichotomy in religions in general between mercy and effort. And we see this such dichotomy, you know, sometimes within ourselves, that we go back and forth and back and forth. And both positions are given in the Shastra and by the Acharyas. You know, I'm working on now Raghunath Das Goswami's Manashiksha with the commentary of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. He has a prose and a song commentary. And it's interesting that Manashiksha is very heavily dependent on mercy, the mood of Manashiksha, that you must be saved by the Vaishnavas, you must be saved by Govardhan Hill, you must be saved by the mercy of Radharani, Lalita, Vishakha, Govardhan, Radhakunda, very dependent on mercy. But Bhaktivinoda Thakur says in the purport that if you think I'm just going to sit around and wait for mercy, it will never happen. If you think just one day I'll be lucky, You know, I can be slack in my own effort, and one day I'll be lucky, and if it comes, it comes, and if it doesn't come, it doesn't come. He says you'll never achieve anything. And we find that Raghunath Das Goswami, even in talking about mercy, talks about our doing something. He talks about at least our begging for mercy, our asking for mercy, our praying for mercy. And Bhaktivinoda Thakura lists in his commentary so many prayers to each of these personalities that we could pray as a way of asking for mercy. So we're going to look at this, and what do we mean by our effort? What effort do we need to make? And what mercy? How do we get mercy? Because this verse is making the point, effort is not enough, but it's required. In logic, we call this necessary and sufficient conditions. So, give a little example. If you're going to make any kind of bread, you need to have some sort of flour. Without flour, bread is not bread. Right? Even like today's Ekadasi. So even if you're going to make some Ekadasi bread, you have to have some kind of flour. It may be flour from potatoes. It may be flour from buckwheat. But you have to have some kind of flour, otherwise it's not bread. But simply having flour is not enough. Even if you're going to make the very simplest kind of bread, a roti, a chapati, you need to also have water and heat. Now, if you just have water, that's not enough. And if you just have heat, that's not enough. But you have to have water and you have to have a source of heat. Even if you have bread that's baked by the sun, you still have to have the heat of the sun. So flour is necessary, but it's not sufficient. If you say, I'm going to try to make chapatis without flour, it's not possible. But if you say, I'm only going to have flour, then that is also not possible. So let's look at our effort. So our effort has to start with finding a guru. That is the beginning. Without finding a guru, without finding a guide, then our, you know, Prabhupada's saying here we can get nearer. We'll hardly even start. We have to have some guide on this journey. We have to have some guide on this journey. And I think that's true with anything. If you want to learn about medicine, if you want to learn about how to sew, how to drive a car, one needs to have some guide. And what to speak of something that's beyond the range of our senses? Adhokshaja, this idea of the Lord with this navel from which comes the lotus that contains the universe. How in the world could one even know that such a thing exists without, what to speak of, trying to see it or to find it without some kind of a guide? There's a point that one could come without a guru, or we should say without an official guru. The gurus of nature would be sufficient. We've talked about this many times. We don't have time to go into it in depth today. But just from the gurus of nature, one could understand there must be a God, and there must be ultimately one God, and that God must be very clever, very intelligent, very artistic, very devoted to individuality, full of routines and order and yet surprises. That God must be very efficient in conservation of energy. I mean, so many things one can understand without having a particular guru, just by observing nature and having thoughtfulness. But beyond that, one would have to have a guru to understand what is the process and what is the ultimate goal. And then after having this guru, one has to make some effort to follow the guru's instructions. And the guru is going to give two sets of instructions. Just like the word shilanam, Rupa Goswami gives us the word shilanam, activities. So these activities are explained by Jiva Goswami Vishwanath Thakavati Thakur, that these activities are both internal and external. So there's external activities that the guru gives, right? You rise early in the morning, you chant the Hare Krishna mantra, you offer Mangal Arati, you worship the deities, you read the shastras, you offer your food to Krishna. These are all external activities Right? You preach Krishna consciousness, as Srila Prabhupada specifically asked us to distribute his books. But in some way, you preach Krishna consciousness, you distribute prasadam, you distribute books, you distribute the holy name to the public. So these are the external instructions, and somebody can do those externals, at least for quite some time, without following the internal instructions. That's entirely possible, although difficult in the age of Kali Yuga, especially no meat eating, no illicit sex, no gambling, no intoxication, you know, steady with 16 rounds, if you don't also have the internal together. But we have seen it. And another effort that we need to make, as I mentioned earlier, is to beg for mercy. We have to actually ask for mercy. This asking for mercy is, it's not so easy. It's not so easy. Maybe in some cultures it's easier than others, but I know for us Americans, it's hard to ask for any help with anything. We're raised that, you know, you should be independent, you should do it yourself. I mean, if we think about when I'm in India or even visiting expat Indians, generally the parents are putting the food right in the child's mouth from a young age. And even when the child may be, you know, 10 years old, the parents are doing this. Sometimes they're following the child around the house, putting food in their mouth. So such behavior would be very strange in America. In America, we expect our children to feed themselves from a young age. So it may be difficult to ask for mercy. It may be difficult to ask for help. And ultimately, asking for mercy, really asking for mercy, although it's an external behavior, although it's a question of opening the mouth and saying some words, it requires an internal effort. It requires something internal. Asking for mercy particularly requires a mood of humility. And it's interesting enough, I was really meditating on this fact this morning, this humility. Is it the beginning? Is it the end? You know, in Manashiksha, Raghunath Das Goswami starts out in his very first verse, Dambam Hitva, give up your pride. And yet it's not until the end of the internal section, text 7, that he says that we must give up all desire for honor. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur explains that the root of our material contamination is the desire for honor. Raghunath Das Goswami compares this desire for honor to a promiscuous woman, an unchaste woman, or perhaps even a professional prostitute, and honor itself to the meat of a dog. So this unchaste woman who dances in the heart, this desire for honor, she's eating dog meat. And this is the last of these subtle anartas that need to be removed from the heart. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur says this unchaste woman has a lover, Upapati, not a husband, a lover, whose name is deceit, pretense. That once we want honor, once we want other people to honor us, we become pretentious. We pretend we're something that we're not in order to get honor. Because if we were honest about who and what we are, we wouldn't get any honor. If we said to people, you know, look, I'm a really insignificant living entity. I'm full of bad qualities. I make tons of mistakes. I'm motivated by my own selfishness. Why would anybody honor us? If we said everything that we achieved is as much or more due to circumstances and the help of others as to my own effort is a tiny part in this, why would we receive honor? So we pretend. We have deceit. And this deceit, Raghunath Das Goswami compares in text 6, to a donkey's urine, that although it seems that you're taking a bath, it's actually just burning you and making you stinky and dirty, right? I mean, whenever we recognize people's deceit, we become disgusted. And then this deceit, this produces our being buffeted about by lust, anger, envy, greed, and illusion. Kamadi, he says in verse 5, the six enemies. Hachividam narakashidam dwaramatmanamatmana karmakrotas tatalobas tasmadeta twayam twajet. All these six enemies of lust, anger, envy, greed, illusion, madness, and so forth, that all comes from pretense. Why? Because we're pretending to be some we're pretending to be this body, we're pretending to be an enjoyer in the world, and then this brings all these, okay, if I'm an enjoyer in the world, then I'm going to lust after the things in the world. When I can't get them, I become angry. When someone else has them, I become envious. Going through this cycle of lust, anger, and envy makes me crazy. And then, in verse 4, he gives the outer layer, a desire for liberation, for merging, an attraction for Narayan and Vaikuntha, in other words, an attraction to the opulences of the Lord, and also just being interested in ordinary worldly talks, being interested in the things of the world. This is in text 4, the most superficial layer. So he's going from superficial down to deep, give up interest in mundane conversation and wanting to merge with God or wanting to enjoy the opulences of God, then give up lust, anger, envy, greed, and illusion, then give up pretense, and then finally give up the desire for honor, which is feeding all of this. But in the very first verse, he says, give up pride. So I was thinking about it. You know, if you've given up all pride in the first verse, then why would you need to go all the way deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper until you give up the desire for honor, which is the root of the whole mess? Because if you don't give up pride, at least to some extent in the beginning, you can't go through that internal process. You just can't. Therefore, Krishna says also, right, in the 13th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, when he gives the process of knowledge, he also starts with humility. Now, that's not a full giving up of pride. A full giving up of pride isn't done until we give up the desire for honor, which is obviously connected with pride. It's not exactly pride itself, but it has a relationship with pride. But we have to start out at least with the humility that we can understand at the beginning. So therefore, in order to do the external of begging for mercy, we have to do this internal of at least giving up pride. At least on some level to start. And then, fascinatingly enough, as we go through the rest of the internals, we are begging more and more and more for mercy. But we are begging for mercy to give up those internal attachments. That's what we're begging for mercy for. When we're begging for mercy also to get the positive attachment at each state that Raghunath Das Goswami, at each verse where he says, give up the internal attachments, he's simultaneously saying, and cultivate these spiritual attachments at every step. When he says, stop bathing in donkey urine, he says, bathe in the ocean of love of God, of Radha and Krishna. When he says, give up lust, anger, envy, greed, illusion, which are like highwaymen who bound you by the rope, he says, you do this by calling out to the servants of the killer of Bakasura. Why? Because Bakasura symbolizes deceit. Bakasura is a crane. A crane looks like it's meditating, like a yogi standing on one foot, very detached. And as soon as there's a fish, stops its meditation, goes for the fish. Deceitful. So the enemy, the devotees of the enemy of Baka call for them. So this is always his other side. Other side, instead of the dancing, unchaste woman eating dog, you know, you call for Sadhu Prema. Prema is feminine. You call for the lady of love of God to enter into the heart. So in order to have, again, this external activity, this effort of asking for mercy, one has to feel one needs mercy. One has to feel one can't make it by one's own effort. Isn't that interesting? To make an effort with the mood that my effort is not enough. And for that, we have to work on the internals, which is mostly a state of wanting to work on the internals and asking for help to work on the internals. So that is our effort. It's an interesting kind of effort. That sort of effort is not the effort of I'm going to set my alarm for 4 o'clock and wake up for it. It's not that kind of effort. I'm going to work hard to buy a ticket and get on a plane and go to Vrindavan and do a parikrama with. It's not that kind of effort. I'm going to make sure that I have real ghee, and I'm going to make wicks, and I'm going to offer a real ghee wick every day, and I'm going to make my mouth say these prayers. It's not that kind of effort. It's a different kind of effort. It's an effort where one says, I want to be cleansed internally no matter what it costs. No matter what the price. I want this. I want it, and I can't do it myself. I need help, but I want it, and I'm going to beg for it because I can't do it myself, and I need it. A very simple analogy is like when people are addicted to some sort of drug, but they don't admit that they're addicted. The alcoholic who doesn't, they don't admit that they're an alcoholic. It's not, they think, oh, I just, you know, I drink a little much, but it's not really a problem. I'm certainly not an alcoholic. I can deal with this myself. I can deal with this myself. You know, so I've got a bunch of teenage grandkids. There's a funny saying, you know, teenagers move out of the house and get a job while you still know everything, right? So try to tell a teenager what they need to work on, and they'll say, leave me alone, I can deal with it myself. I don't need your help to deal with it. So, you know, this attitude that, oh, my problems are small. I don't really have any problems. I don't really have any problems. And whatever problems I have, I can deal with them myself. Right? So the effort one has to make is to face one's problems, to be willing to face one's problems and be willing to ask for help. And we see that there's a number of religions, especially I think Christianity, that give external behaviors for this kind of effort, the confessional, where you go and you say to some priest, I have this problem and I need help. And such is one of the main factors in any kind of treatment program for addiction, that you have to get up in front of other people and say, I am a drug addict. I am an alcoholic. I need help. Some time ago, I read a book by a gentleman who, and I read the whole thing, but anyway, he's a very successful counselor of people who are abusers of their spouse, people who have beaten their spouse, physically harm their spouse. And he pointed out that the majority of people who engage in this kind of behavior will not go all the way for treatment because they will not admit that they really have a problem. They'll say, yeah, I shouldn't do this. I shouldn't, you know, it's a problem. Yeah, it's a problem, but I can deal with it. He said it's only the people that really see how serious the problem is and that they need help who really give up that behavior. And we might find this problem in ourselves. You know, people tell me, devotees tell me all the time, oh, I'm not really proud. I don't have any envy. I just love Krishna. Right? So this is the effort we have to make, to find a guru, to follow the externals, and to follow this internal of at least a perfunctory humility, something that's genuine, not just, I'm so fallen, Prabhu. All right, where do we get this mercy? How do we get this mercy? If we've got all these internals and externals of our effort, how do we get this mercy, which is the last step? As Prabhupada says here, we can come nearby, but we can't go to the ultimate point. We can't go to the ultimate point. Where do we get this mercy? Well, ultimately, we have to get this mercy from the person that we are offending. And I've given this analogy many times, right? If somebody's cheated us, right? I've had people in my life who've cheated me, been mean to me. I assume that all of us have. Somebody who's deceived us. Somebody who we helped, perhaps, maybe significantly. And then they turned on us. You know, or we help them and then they claimed everything as their own. I've had this. You know, you do all the work and then someone gets up and takes all the credit for it themselves. Or just cheats you. You know, says they're your friend, steals from you, badmouths you, talks behind your back. So if such a person comes and says, I want the relationship back, if their offense against us was very great, we might be happy that they've come and said, I want to say I'm sorry, but we don't immediately accept them back in full. We test them. We observe whether or not they're sincere, because if they've cheated us once, well, they could do it again. And I think I get kind of a mental picture of this, you know, this spouse cheated on their spouse, husband cheated on wife cheated on husband, who's come back and said, I want to come back. And the offended person may say, you know, well, not into the house yet. You can kind of sit on the steps. The person who's committed the offense cannot say, well, I've said I'm sorry, you have to let me back in. They can't demand. Right? Can someone demand like that with us? If someone's cheated us, can they just come and make a demand? Now you have to let me. No, we have to choose. We have to extend our hand. We have to say, all right, I accept you back. So that's why ultimately we need mercy, because we're the offenders, and the offended party is the one who has to extend their hand and agree to accept our apology, to agree to trust us. Now, people talk a lot about, how can I have faith in God? How can I trust God? But the real question is, can God trust us? And so we need mercy from the Lord himself, who we've offended, but frankly, by offending the Lord, we've also offended the devotees. Right? If you offend a man, then his wife and children will also feel offended. If you offend a child, the mother and father, brothers and sisters, will also feel offended. A lot of the wars in the world are like that. You know, you killed my brother, you killed my father, I'm going to avenge their death, blah, blah, blah. So it works like that in the transcendental realm. So we need mercy from not only Krishna, but also from Krishna's devotees. And in fact, if Krishna's devotees recommend us to Krishna, then he's very likely to accept us. And Prabhupada says if we please the devotees, then even if we're not really qualified for Krishna's mercy, Krishna will extend his mercy just to please his devotees. So we need mercy from Krishna himself. We need ultimately Krishna himself to extend his hand. It is said that no jiva can give liberation, even Shiva and Brahma. No one except Krishna ultimately. Shiva and Brahma are gurus. They're the head of sampradayas. But yet ultimately Krishna must give. Ultimately it must be Krishna. Yasya prasada bhagavat prasada. Yasya prasada nagati katopi. By the mercy of guru, one gets the mercy of Krishna. So it's not exactly that the devotees ultimately can give liberation. It's Krishna who gives, only Krishna. No jiva can give liberation, only Krishna. So we have to ultimately get the mercy of Krishna. Just like if you want to graduate from a university, your diploma is signed by the dean of the university. So it's really your professors in your classroom and the head of the department who've said, yes, this person can graduate. And it's almost automatic that if the people that you're dealing with directly certify that you can graduate, that the head of the college, the head of the university, will sign the paper. It's almost automatic. But still, there is a person signing the paper. He has to sign off on it. He might choose not to. He has freedom. And then we have to get, as we're saying, the mercy of the devotees, particularly the mercy of guru, who's working with us directly. Right, the Diksha Guru is the one who officially brings us into the Sampradaya. The Shiksha Gurus, who may be the same person, they're instructing us within the Sampradaya. They have to agree. They have to sign off. They have to say, yes, this person is okay. This person's not, they can be admitted. So we need their mercy. We need the mercy of the devotees and Krishna in the ultimate sense to admit us to the spiritual world, to remove all of our anarthas. And we need their mercy step by step by step to reveal each of our anarthas as we go deeper and more subtle. And we need their mercy to reveal themselves to us. We can't force that. We can't say, okay, Lalita and Vishaka, come here and see me. We can't even ask the flowers and the blades of grass of the spiritual world to do that. So for the ultimate step, for each step, for showing themselves, we need the mercy of Krishna and the devotees. Those are who we beg for mercy. So we see it's not really a question of, is it mercy or is it effort? It's an ongoing relationship. And we start at the very beginning, making an effort to find Guru, and Guru appears by the mercy of Guru and by the mercy of Krishna. Then the Guru gives instructions by mercy, and by our effort we follow those external instructions. And then we make an effort of humility, which then awakens the mercy of the devotees and Krishna to reveal our inartas. Then we make an effort to accept those revelations. We make an effort to believe what has been revealed to us. We make an effort to ask for them to be removed no matter what the cost. And then there is mercy that they are removed. We make an effort to beg to enter into the eternal realm. And when there's mercy of revelation, we make an effort again to embrace that mercy. You know, I've met many, many devotees who got some revelation of their eternal spiritual form, but never did anything to cultivate that revelation. So whatever it may be, we get a revelation of our pride or envy, or we get a revelation of our eternal form. We have to act on that revelation. And as we act on it, then the beings who are giving us mercy, God himself and his devotees, they'll reveal more. And as they reveal more, we act on it more. Then they'll reveal more and we act on it more. And they'll reveal more and we act on it more. If we follow the externals, they'll facilitate our following the externals. Even on that level, devotees will say, I can't chant, I don't have time to chant my rounds. Chant your rounds anyway. And then you know Krishna will give you nice facility. It works like that. So the conflict is an imaginary one. It's a relationship, like any relationship, even a material relationship. You want to have a relationship with some other jiva in this world. It's a question of I have to make the effort and the other person has to extend towards me. We have to extend towards each other. It's not one-sided. This is a person. I'm a person. Krishna is a person. Krishna's associates are persons. If I think I can force a relationship through my own effort, then I certainly haven't even started with humility. And if I think that I'm going to do nothing, but simply say I want a relationship and everything is going to come from Krishna and the devotee side, that I also haven't started with humility. So both are there. I make the maximum effort I am capable of at this particular point in my spiritual evolution, which keeps increasing. And I expect and ask for the maximum mercy. And then I use it nicely when it comes. So if we do that, then our progress is very fast. If we accept this relationship, this dance between our effort and the extension of the hand. And frankly, although it seems to us that we are making a gargantuan effort for a very long time, it seems like that to us from our perspective often, that this is a very hard job that goes on forever. And we should be prepared for it being like that. Srila Prabhupada said, no matter how much I have to endeavor for the many crores of my coming births in the world because of my sins. Srimati Rukmini Devi said this. She said, if I have to do austerities for many, many lifetimes. So it may seem to us like that. You know, Mukunda said, I'll see you after 10 million lifetimes of devotion. But really, it's not. Really, the effort that we are making relative to how fallen we are is very small. The main ground is really covered by mercy. It really is. it seems like we're working so hard and we're struggling so much. I just like a little child. So the little child asks for help, and you say, well, you try first. Try to do it yourself. And the child is, from their perspective, working very hard. But as soon as we see that the child has exhausted their efforts, we come in and we help them. Therefore, the demigods say, it looks like there's an ocean we have to cross. It looks like it's a huge ocean. And we can't, how can we cross it by our own effort? Then we see there's a boat of the Lord's lotus feet, and we think, oh, I have to make an effort to go to that boat and get in the boat and stay in the boat. But we find as soon as we approach the boat, the ocean effectively disappears. So the effort is not what we think it is. It's not really a Pacific Ocean worth of effort. It's really one step of effort. It's really one step. It's the same step over and over again, I suppose, but it's one step. I want to know you. I am willing to see the truth. I am willing to believe the truth. I am willing to act on the truth. So questions, comments?